Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and I'm really pleased to have back Erin Presley. She is horticulturist at Obrick Botanical Gardens in Madison. Does a lot over there. She cares for the herb, wildflower, and pond gardens. And so I'm going to talk with her, at least to begin with, about growing herbs. We'll take your calls as well. It could be about herbs, could be about almost anything else, as a matter of fact. She'll take a crack at it. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Erin Presley, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
I'm really happy to be in the studio today here, Larry.
Let's talk about, just to begin with, what's going on at the gardens right now?
You know, Obrick Gardens is just always a thriving place full of activity. So we're looking at our last couple nights of Gleam, which is a just really popular light and art installation that we host in the garden through the months of September and October. So all throughout the garden, you'll find a series of exhibits that have been created specific to particular garden areas at Obrick by artists really from throughout the United States, and even sometimes international artists will host. And we have just a full array of also landscape lighting that ties together the spaces between the exhibits that's really beautiful and highlights the architecture and plant material in the garden. So we're looking at wrapping that up this weekend. There's still time to visit on Friday and Saturday nights. And then next week, you know, we have a lot of fun educational opportunities and kids activities. So actually on Tuesday the 31st, we're hosting a drop-in pumpkin decorating activity for kids from 2:30 to 4 in our learning center. And then coming up on November 4th, which is a Saturday, we are very happy to host the Madison Herb Fair, which is put on every year by the Madison Herb Society.
Yeah, that is always a lot of fun. Well, first, Gleam is a lot of fun. I've always enjoyed visiting to see Gleam. The herb fair is also fun, and maybe just describe what's going on and so forth.
Yes, the herb fair is just really something I look forward to every year at Obrick. I think we're looking at the 41st or 42nd herb fair. Yeah, and so the Herb Society puts together a great lineup of speakers. This year, the theme is actually herbal seasons and cycles. So throughout the day at 10:30, 12:30, and 2:30, they have talks going on by Sam Thayer, who is a Wisconsin foraging expert.
Good friend. He's been on the show many a time.
Yeah, I heard he was on just recently. He's written a number of really popular books that kind of demystify wild foods and interpret what you see around you and how they can be safely used and cooked in your kitchen, no matter what the season is. And then at 12:30, they'll be having a lecture from Jane Hawley Stevens, and she'll be touching on themes from her new book, The Celestial Garden, Growing Herbs, Vegetables, and Flowers in Sync with the Moon and Zodiac. And Jane has a just a thriving herb business for Elements Herbal that she has been pioneering really amazing herbal remedies since the 80s, actually. Yeah. So her farm is located up in Baraboo. And then at 2:30, they're hosting Kevin Olson from Northwoods Tea and Herb, which is based in Wausau, Wisconsin. And he's a forest ecologist, and he'll be talking about a lot of his business actually focuses on foraged mushrooms and how those can be sustainably harvested and then prepared throughout, all seasons of the year. And then he also, I think, will be touching a lot on some of his other products that he sells through his store, which really, from what I could see, have a lot of focus on a lot of mushrooms that can be easily incorporated kind of into your daily life. Because when we look at a lot of herbs, a lot of them really have benefits that are most prevalent if you eat them over a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of medicinal mushrooms that are native here in Wisconsin actually give you the best benefits with almost like daily consumption. So it's a lot more thinking of, herbs as food versus something that you're just ingesting only when something is going wrong with you. So in addition to all these great speakers, then they also have a wonderful array of herbal vendors from throughout the state. So anything, you know, bakery, candles, teas, artwork, just amazing array of products there. There's also a question and answer table. So between the people who run the table and then just all of the other wealth of knowledge of the people that are there, it's just an amazing resource and really fun to see the people that all are brought together around this fantastic topic of how herbs work with us and work for us through the seasons.
And time and so forth?
Yeah, so it's on Saturday, November 4th, and it is from 10 o'clock in the morning until 4. And also our Bolst Conservatory is open, so if it's cold outside, you'll have opportunities to get into a little rainforest climate there, as well as the outdoor gardens are still looking just superb going into the late fall here. And, you know, a little bit of frost doesn't hold us back. We have lots and lots to see as the weather gets a little colder over the next week.
Fantastic place. I'm glad to be a member. I have a membership there, and I enjoy visiting throughout the whole seasons. And in the winter, to go to the Bolts Conservatory is really a lot of fun.
It's really a treat, you know? It's just like a vacation that's right here at home.
Well, Isla in Little Chute has a question. Let's go there. Isla, hi.
Hi. I have a kitchen garden with some a very large, almost 3 foot tall basil plant. Plus, I have thyme and rosemary and oregano. And they're large plants as well. And now with the winter coming, I've always wondered each year, is there any way or what way should I use to dry them so I can use them through the winter season?
Great. That's a really good question. I know here in Madison, we're looking at some of our first real frost potential in the next couple nights.
Yeah.
So, yeah, great timing. The main tip that I give people when they are looking to dry herbs for the winter is find the warmest, most well-ventilated place in your house, or even consider investing in a dryer. When you think of really capturing the best oils and flavors of those herbs, ideally you'll find a place in your home where it's upwards of 90 degrees and has good ventilation, so you can really be bringing those herbs in and dry them down to kind of a crunchy texture in a relatively short period of time. So I have a really wonderful commercial dryer at home, and you are able to control the temperature and dry things down really quickly. Another really good spot is on a ventilated rack. So if you have like a baking cooling rack where air can circulate all the way around the herbs, and then lay them out in a thin, flat layer on top of the rack, on top of your refrigerator. Because a lot of times the extra heat from the motor on the refrigerator makes that kind of like a little microclimate in your home. So you really just want to find the warmest spot, you know, next to a heating vent is good, as long as you're hopefully not having air blow right over them. And then you're just going to be waiting until the herbs are dry enough that they can be crumbled between your fingers. So to be safe for storage, you need them to be dried down to the extent where you can kind of crunch them up. And then some of the more delicately flavored herbs like basil, I think, is actually a really good candidate to freeze as opposed to dry, because it really preserves a little bit more of that summer fresh flavor. So a lot of times with basil, I will put that, clip the leaves off and then freeze them in a little sandwich bag with like a little olive oil drizzled between the layers. And then that's really handy for in the winter. You can kind of break off a little chunk of that frozen basil, and it really tastes like it just came in from the garden from the summer.
All good tips. So if you've got a food dryer at home, you can use, it works fine for herbs.
Oh, definitely.
Not just venison or what some of our folks would have a food processor.
Right,
food dryer
right.
For.
So the dryer, usually for herbs, you'll put it on one of the lowest temperature settings that it has. Otherwise, if you have a dryer that only has one, offers one temperature, just keep an eye on them because you really want them to get just dry enough that they are kind of crunchy, like I had mentioned. But there's no benefit in over-drying them to the extent where they start to lose their flavor.
Emily, Ralph, our engineer today, says they dry their basil all summer.
Yeah, actually, it's really good for a lot of the herbs if you can start thinking about preserving them earlier in the summer or in early fall when the weather is still hot, and you can take advantage of kind of naturally warmer temperatures in your home to get them to be dried down a little bit more quickly. And some of the more kind of sturdy herbs, like if you would think of rosemary or oregano, where they're already a little bit more kind of woody, those are a little bit more adaptable to a longer drying time, say if you just hung them in small bunches. Another thing that's important when you're drying herbs is to try to keep the sun off of them. So keep them in a dark, warm closet and then hang them in really small bundles. Air circulation is really important, so don't make the bundles too big. And then I always think it's, important to really only be drying the nicest parts. So before you are hanging things up to dry, inspect them for any insect damage. Make sure you're stripping off any lower leaves that may have been close to the soil where they would have gotten, dirt splashed up on them.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you dry them, you really want them to be in a state that's like ready to throw right into a dish when you're cooking in the winter.
Isla, thank you so much for calling. Lou in Bayfield, we go to you. Thank you for calling.
Hey there. Good good late morning. Would you please recommend some books that we could look to if we work full-time and can't get to any of the wonderful classes that are offered for foraging, and that would include mushrooms? I need to wrap mushrooms in my diet. I need to wrap that around my brain.
Well,
yeah,
Sam Thayer's books would come into play, I think, but...
Oh, definitely. I would say that when I think of the top resource that I always go to are the books by Sam Thayer, because the advantage of that, too, is if you're from Wisconsin or the upper Midwest, he is based, I believe, out of the Driftless area.
Mm-hmm.
And so his recommendations really time out well with what you'd be looking for in Wisconsin. So his first book that he came out with is called Forager's Harvest. And that one is like kind of a broad overview of what you could be harvesting throughout the whole year. And then the one that I look to a little bit more frequently is called Nature's Garden. And that one focuses a little bit more on plants that are pretty abundant no matter where you are and have like a wide variety of uses. So as a starter reference, I think that would be the two things that I would really look to.
I think he deals with mushrooms in that second book, doesn't he?
Yeah, I have never... the mushroom books that I tend to look at are usually produced by Paul Stamets, who's actually out of British Columbia, who has a lot of... Pacific Northwest. So I don't really have a lot of experience with guides for mushrooms that are based here in the Midwest. But I think if you checked out Kevin Olson again, who's at the Herb Fair from 2:30 to 3:30. His company is based in Wausau, and on his website, he already is kind of interpreting and breaking down a lot of the mushrooms that he forages for here in Wisconsin, and then how they can be combined into herbal preparations. So I think that would be a really good initial resource that could lead you to some good field guides and other types of resources.
I think that's a good idea. Kevin Olson, again, the name Olson.
Yeah, and his company is called Northwoods Tea and Herb.
Lou, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. email address, ideas@wpr.org. Started by talking about herbs, and we're still continuing that, but we'll take other questions as well as we move along, and certainly I hope you'll join in. Hey, Emily Ralph, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network for Garden Talk. Aaron Presley, horticulturist at Olbricht Botanical Gardens. We've started again by talking herbs, but we can talk wildflowers, we can talk pond gardens, we can talk pretty much anything you probably want to talk about. We'll be able to help out in the gardening area. 1-800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. And Jill was reminding me that Sam Thayer was on the show July 6th. To talk about his field guide to edible wild plants of Eastern and Central North America. That was the topic of that show, and that was July 6th. So you can go back to ideas@wpr.org/Larry and go to July 6th, and you'll find that show to listen to if you're interested. Jay in Green Lake has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jay.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. Not so much a question, but I found several Facebook groups that are here in Wisconsin that deal with foraging and wild mushrooms that have been very helpful in getting me introduced to the topic. And then specifically on mushrooms, the state, the Wisconsin Mycological Society, actually offers a course that helps you identify. So some people like to do stuff in person and, you know, talk to a human and go out in the field with them, et cetera. And then other people do a little bit of learning on the internet. But I found both of those things as valuable resources, especially in the, you know, in the mushroom identification categories.
Yeah. Good points, Jay. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Very good advice. Christina in Glenwood, we'll go to you. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. Now, I've got a pineapple sage that I have been growing for 10 years, no problem. I can never grow rosemary. Can you please advise me? I love it.
Inside, you're talking about. Yeah, you can grow
inside,
it outside.
Absolutely, yep.
Yeah, outside, not too much of a problem. Inside, a bit more.
We have many nice rosemary plants at Olbricht Gardens that we overwinter from year to year. And there are a few tricks. So one of them that's really important, I always think, is if you have a rosemary plant that you want to grow inside over the winter, grow it outside just in a pot in the summer so that, you know, at this time of year or even earlier when the weather starts to turn cold, instead of digging up a plant that's in the ground, putting it in a pot, and then bringing it inside, that's a lot of stress on the plant. It's a lot easier if you have a rosemary that's already potted, and then what you're doing is just bringing it into your home. Another tip that is really important is many plants, when they're adapting to a home condition, what is really shocking for them is the decrease in the light levels. So even what you think of as your sunniest window is still has quite a bit less light than actually being outside. So you want to make that acclimation gradual. So, you know, it would be better if you had been starting this process in, say, September. So you'll hopefully be having your pre-potted rosemary, or if you have one that you're digging up, you know, out of the ground trying to bring in, do that as early as you can. And then before you bring it into your home, move it into an area of your garden that's shadier than where it had been growing over the summer. So it's kind of giving the plant those signals to get used to a situation that approximate home light conditions. So those are some good tips. Another kind of interesting one is that in a Mediterranean climate, most of the rain actually would be coming over the winter. So although rosemary, where it's outside during the summer, adapts to drought really well, when you're bringing that plant into your house in the winter, you don't want to overwater it, but you can give it a little bit more ample water than you maybe think it was relying on outside in the summer. So you're going to be one of keeping it, you know, relatively evenly moist when it's in your home in the winter. Those are my best recommendations. I know, and there's, you know, folks out there, especially if you talk to some of the people at the Herb Society, where they, you know, and they're experts. The people in the Herb Society, I can't hold a candle to the knowledge that they collectively and individually possess. And even there, you know, there'll be people that'll say, oh, I had the most gorgeous rosemary I brought in and out for 5 years. And then, you know, last winter, it just... You know, that was it. Kick the bucket. So just don't, it's, you know, worth a try. The other thing that, again, just is colloquial knowledge, but I've heard that the more cascading varieties of rosemary, so there's a Prostratus, which is a prostrate variety. We grow Roman Beauty, which is kind of a moundy cascading variety. Some of those can be easier to overwinter than some of the more upright varieties. So all these little nuances kind of go into it. So the best of luck to you.
Christina, thanks. And just to go along, as long as we're talking rosemary, Linda in Appleton wants to dig up her rosemary and bring it inside for the winter to stuff her turkey and use in cocktails. She read about mixing 9 parts of water and 1 part of hydrogen peroxide and spraying it to keep powdery mildew at bay. I hadn't heard of that.
I have never done that personally, but I know that a lot of peroxide-based products are used in kind of general sanitation for plants.
Sure.
And also even in like washes for fruits and vegetables. So if you had a, you know, what you would consider a trusted source that was telling you to use that ratio, plus I think it's mild enough that you wouldn't be harming the plant at all. I can't say that I've ever... done anything like that. And typically I think the rosemary is not really a plant that usually if they're outside and they're grown in appropriate cultural conditions, it's not super likely that they're bringing in a lot of pest or disease problems in the first place.
And Linda also wanted to know that besides her use in turkey stuffing and for cocktails, she wonders, what other tips about uses for rosemary?
Yeah, I think rosemary has a really nice scent for like a simmer pot in the winter. So if you have a candle with one of those little burners where you can add wax that has herbs in it or even water or just, you know, don't overthink it and just do a pot on the stove with some water, maybe some rosemary, cloves, some other nice fall spices. Yeah, that's one of my favorite things to do because I feel like rosemary is a scent that usually most people like. As long as it's not too strong, rosemary can be a little, you know, some of the varieties of rosemary can be a little bit more piney or kind of pungent than others, but I love a nice rosemary simmer pot. The other thing it can be really good for, since rosemary does have natural antiseptic properties, is it can be a good addition to cleaning products. So if you have a lot of times at home, I'll make like a vinegar-based cleaner, and then I'll take, just regular white household vinegar and then steep some rosemary sprigs in it for a couple days before I use that to dilute it with some water. And, even if you have just some other kind of soap that you use for general household cleaning, adds kind of a nice fragrance and makes a really good general purpose household cleaner.
Oh, nice idea. I like that. Christina, again, thank you. Art in Norway. Art, are you in Norway?
We're in the town of Norway. Between Racine and Waukesha County.
Oh, okay. There you go. What's on your mind?
I don't know if you can help me or not. Arborvitae, growing them outside. Evergreen arborvitae. We're having a hard time getting them to take. We plant them. We bought them from a big box store down here. But they last for about a year, maybe 18 months, and they just start turning brown from the top down and just dry up and they're gone.
Yeah.
Just any hints on it.
Yeah, what is your soil like over there? Arborvitae Thuja occidentalis is a very can be very drought tolerant once established. But just like any other evergreen, they really, especially in some of these really dry summers, we had horrible drought here in Dane County throughout basically the entirety of 2023. So even if you had a nice plant that made it through the winter well, but it wasn't really fully established, they really can very quickly show drought stress. So I'm kind of curious about what your, you know, what sort of watering schedule you're following or what type of soil you're growing these plants in.
Okay, the soil, first off, the topsoil is about 2 to 3 inches, maybe 4 inches. And then underneath that is clay. It's really hard to dig into. What we've done, we've tried different things on it. We've bought the starter soil to pack around it or to put it around it when we plant it. Nothing seems to work on it. I go down, you know, the recommendation is to dig a hole about twice the size of the plant when you're planting it and go down so the root ball is right even with the soil. I went down that far. I went down further, you know, go down like 10 or 12 inches and then put this root starter in there, hoping that that would do it. And it doesn't seem like anything I do or try just doesn't work. Watering, we try to water it during the summertime and about every other week. We put the hose down there and water it deeply or put a lot of water on them, let me put it that way.
Two
other recommendations that I think could maybe contribute to your success is when you are, so every other week for a plant that's just getting established really probably is not enough water, especially if we're not getting consistent rainfall and you're already working with kind of clayey or poor soil. Typically when we at Ulbrich Gardens are trying to establish, especially evergreens, we will be watering, you know, for the first 2 to 3 months of the plant, especially if it's, you know, hot, dry summers, watering them 2 times a week. And then maybe, you know, have a way that you can measure how much water you're putting on there. So I would say, you know, a 5-gallon bucket twice a week per plant, or some way that you can kind of track how much water you're applying can be really helpful. The other thing that when you're describing the size and the amendments you're adding to the holes, that's important to make a good sized planting hole. Usually if you kind of make them the shape of a saucer where they're, you know, arborvitae typically have a lot of roots that run at the surface level. So if you have a nice shallow wide hole, sounds like that's something you're really doing well. The other thing that can help a lot, again, provided that you're really getting enough water on these plants, is when we plant trees and shrubs, and especially evergreens, if you're getting them from a big box store, when you pull them out of the pots and they have very tightly compacted root systems, so the roots just come out basically exactly in the shape of the pot it was grown in, it really helps a lot to take a sharp tool, like a little 3-pronged cultivator, the edge of a sharp shovel, if you have like a weeding knife, and start massaging and breaking up that root system. It can even help if it's really tightly compacted within, pot bound within the pot, to soak the entire root system in water for an hour before you put it in the ground so that you can start to tease those roots apart and get a lot of those feeder roots out expanded into the soil profile versus just being stuck in that little pot-shaped clump that they probably came out of the pot in.
That's a really good advice.
Yeah.
And the other I'd mention, and you've been talking watering, but I think with evergreens too, and I'm sure you will agree with me on this, you want those evergreens watered right up until the ground freezes.
Until the ground freezes. Yeah, that's really important. If you think of our deciduous trees, they all lose their leaves going into the winter. So they have very limited ways that they're losing water over the winter. But any type of evergreen, its needles are still all exposed to the elements of the winter. And so it can be losing water actively the whole winter. So we, especially with how dry, you know, a lot of Wisconsin was this summer, we're making extra effort to get about the equivalent of like an inch of water on all of our evergreens through every week going up until when the ground freezes. So a good, you know, a 5-gallon bucket of water on those plants, you know, every week up until Thanksgiving, I would say, is a good rule of thumb.
Yeah. Lots to think about there, Art, and to put into practice. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Erin Presley, our guest today, a horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. You can join in with your questions. Love to hear from you. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. The Thai garden is closed, and maybe that at Olbrich Gardens, and maybe you could talk about what's going on there.
Yes, so we actually have a really very significant and exciting rejuvenation happening in the Thai garden, and the Thai sala especially is we're coming up on the 25th anniversary of the pavilion, which was originally a gift to the city of Madison and UW-Madison by the Thai alumni from UW-Madison. And we're very honored to have that pavilion sited at Olbrich Gardens. And there's just fantastic.
It's really cool.
It's amazing. It's one of just very few that are located really anywhere in the world outside of Thailand. And so we are but you know, it is just immaculately decorated. The painting is actually real gold leaf. It was all constructed without the use of metal fasteners. So it's really traditionally constructed. And it had just been starting to show, you know, the number of winters it had been seeing. And so we have been working in partnership with UW-Madison, the Thai consulate out of Chicago, to fund and find the appropriate contractors to do a complete refurbishment of the sala. And so right now it's actually the garden around the pavilion is closed. You can still see it across the creek though, and it's actually really interesting because the contractor that we're working with actually sent their team in from Connecticut, and they specialize in really detailed architectural restoration. So they work on, you know, cathedrals, and they are working through the winter. So the entirety of the pavilion is actually tented and enclosed. And then they will be heating it to the extent that they'll be able to work on the structure through the whole winter. And then in tandem with those activities, we're really looking to kind of archive and bring back into public light a lot of the history of the sala. So one of the things that's been happening is when the roof tiles were installed, the community was invited to write messages of peace on the back of the roof tiles because they were installed actually shortly after 9/11. And so as we're uncovering all these roof tiles, which now are somewhat deteriorating, so the tiles themselves are not structurally sound, but we're still seeing all these amazing messages. So it's kind of like a time capsule. And just, you know, all these really warm vibes that were going into that project at the time. And I think we've really honored in how we've treated the pavilion and with this restoration. So we're kind of trying to figure out what we're going to do with some of those historical elements. And then really looking forward to the garden reopening next year. And then having some really good celebrations looking towards the 25th anniversary, and it's really exciting. So it's a bummer it's closed right now, but it is winter, so you know it's a little bit quieter time, and we're really looking forward to. And we'll also be actually inviting some of the Thai artisans back next year to do some of the more detailed painting and finer elements of the restoration too, which should be really interesting.
Yeah, it should be fantastic. Well, we have callers waiting to join in, so let's go to the phones. And Tanya in Des Plaines, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, how are you folks doing today?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay, so my husband and I, we're kind of amateur gardeners, but we've had our home for a couple of years, and we've had success with most of our plants. However, there are a couple of hydrangeas that we have up front, in the front of our home that seem to die no matter what we do. The hydrangeas on either side seem to do just fine. They flourish great. We've replanted them a couple of times. We've replaced the dirt. We've added fish fertilizer. And we've tried doing different things. The only thing that we can guess is that there's something under the ground that's kind of killing them off. And ironically enough, the neighbors across the street seem to have a similar issue in the same area, where their evergreens just seem to be dying off, and it's just a couple of them that seem to have that issue. So I was wondering if there's anything else that we can do to try and prevent this killing from happening, because we really love the hydrangeas and our home looks great otherwise, but it really makes me sad that, you know, these things turn brown within a few weeks every time that we plant them.
And you've replaced the soil.
Yeah.
So one of the first questions, I guess, is about the siting of these plants, especially if they are plants in a similar location are also struggling at your neighbor's home. Is this like up near the foundation of your house or near any sort of hardscape element like a sidewalk, patio, staircase, anywhere like that?
Yeah, so that's actually a really good question. For our home, it is right there next to our stairs and by the front of our home, specifically for the ones that are dying. The other ones that are not having these issues, they are right next to the home, but not next to the stairs. For our neighbors, it's kind of out in the open. It's not near their home. It's by their backyard area.
All right. Because in your situation, you know, a lot of times whenever you have any of those outdoor architectural elements like stairs or the foundation of your home or a sidewalk, even if you have a layer of, you know, 12 inches of nice soil that's on top of there, frequently underlying all of those hardscape elements, there's a lot of gravel and also gravel that's really heavily compacted. So that can create really harsh cultural conditions for a lot of types of plants. So even if what you're seeing in the top foot of soil looks good, there can be a lot of underlying soil compaction and also just very like drought-like conditions underneath there. So that, although that doesn't really explain what's happening over at your neighbor's home.
But the neighbor's home could be totally different. It might be just a coincidence.
Yeah. Then the other thing that I would think of is, you know, it sounds like you already have some types of hydrangeas that are growing in other areas of your home. And maybe if you're, you know, struggling to have those same plants, the other topic is there's many different types of hydrangeas that people will grow in a home landscape. Hydrangea paniculata is hydrangeas that typically form a very woody, almost like a small tree or a large shrub. They're very more drought tolerant and persist through the winter a lot better. And then if you look at something like hydrangea arborescens, which is the most commonly one grown is Annabelle, which are plants that get to be about waist high and have a big white or lime green mop head. And then there's also hydrangea macrophylla, which is not a plant that I consider suited to any type of drought, conditions in the first place at all. So honestly, just really looking at, you know, get out your nursery tags when you're buying these plants, research what exact type of hydrangea you are continually replacing. But I would say it's time to look at a different plant in these areas. And maybe something, you know, if they're turning brown and just dying off, think of something that's a little bit more drought tolerant. A good maybe substitute that's of a similar scale and has really nice fall interest is chokeberry. So these are native shrubs, the black chokeberry, also known as Aronia, A-R-O-N-I-A, has good drought tolerance. And then it does have fall interest with beautiful black berries and really bright red fall color. So that might be one option to consider that could be of a, you know, scale that's probably appropriate for your front entry. And then, you know, you can't beat going to a good garden center. We have so many amazing independent garden centers here in Wisconsin. And, you know, it's still a good time for planting if you keep plants watered going into the fall. So I would say take some photos of your problem area, describe what you're happening, and take it to a good local garden center where they can set you up with a plant that you might have more success with.
Good luck, Tanya. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Erin Presley, our guest today, horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Erin Presley, horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Questions for her. We've been talking a lot about herbs, but taking other questions, gardening questions as well. Certainly join in at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Jane in Lancaster, Wisconsin. Hi, Jane.
Hi, good morning. My husband has dug up my beautiful geranium that we bought from Sugar and Spice, which is just north of Lancaster, and we're trying to save it. So we have it in a big pot outside that rained the other day, so it's doing. It revived after he dug it up. So I'd like to save it, and I don't know what to do.
Mm. Okay.
Save it over winter and have it planted in the spring is my guess.
It's a pretty big geranium, and it's a beautiful color of pink. I want to save that. And I've seen people put them in sunny windows in the garage, well, in some garage, at least, in a sunny place. And I don't know what to do. I'm new at this, so yep. I have a sunny kitchen window.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, this is it sounds really nice. If you have space and a sunny spot in your home, you should be golden. So hopefully you have put that plant into some nice potting soil. So it is definitely going to benefit, you know, if you're dug it up from outside whatever pot you had it in. As you're repotting it, hopefully you put it in an appropriately sized pot, not too big. One thing that can be kind of hard on plants is when you bring them inside and you put them in a pot that is too big, where there's just a lot of loose soil around the outside potting soil, and they can kind of hold on to a little too much water in all that extra soil. So finding an appropriately sized pot that's not too much bigger than the size of the root ball that you dug out is really helpful. And then, you know, a lot of times, a lot of geranium varieties, whether they're scented geraniums or flowering geraniums outside, they can get pretty gangly by the end of the summer. So you're going to want to probably cut the plant back a little bit. You know, you can probably cut off if it had a lot of vegetative growth or flowers, cut off, you know, maybe about a third of what was there. So it's a little bit more compact and easy to deal with. And then sanitation is also important. So as you're bringing it inside, do your best to pick off any diseased leaves, brown leaves. If there was any leaves that had fallen on like the surface of the potting soil, clean that all up so that what you're bringing in is as clean of a plant as possible. And then I wouldn't give it any fertilizer or anything just as you're bringing it into your home. If you have a sunny window, just let it kind of get used to that spot. Maybe start putting out some new roots in the pot. And then, you know, come February or March, when the days are, you know, maybe starting to get a little bit longer, then you could think about maybe giving it a little splash of like a houseplant fertilizer and get it kind of beefed up and ready to go outside. It's also going to be important when you take it back out in the spring to do a little bit of a hardening off. So, you know, kind of wait until the temperatures are mild and then don't just put it right in bright sun right away. Take it outside and maybe put it in a shady spot outside for a few days and then slowly move it into more of a bright sun condition. But you should have a lot of luck. Yeah. People have all different ways that they overwinter geraniums. But if you're able to keep it alive and in a sunny location and just kind of growing throughout the winter, you should be perfectly fine. You're well on your way to success.
There you go, Jane. Thank you so much. Kathy and Merrill, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have two Annabelle hydrangeas, and I've had them for 7 years. They get huge and beautiful. One blooms and one stays tight budded the whole time.
Oh, that's interesting. So it actually has buds, but they just don't open?
They don't open, yes.
Oh.
And are they growing right next to each other?
Right next to each other. They're like sisters.
Oh, that is really weird. I know my folks have some, I think there's some viral conditions that can affect the Annabelle hydrangeas that will cause them to not flower, especially on like older specimens. But I have never heard of one where it will have the flower buds but not open. And honestly, I doubt that there's anything that you can do to remediate that. That's probably just a genetic thing or, you know, some kind of lurking latent disease problem that probably isn't like a real threat to your plant. But I guess I don't see what you could be doing that would cause that plant to bloom in the future and the buds to open if you have, you know, a healthy floriferous one right next to it. So if it really, you know, if you don't mind it, let it ride. But I think just replacing the plant is really the only thing you're going to be able to do to get a blooming one in that spot. That's really weird.
Yeah, it really is. Kathy, good luck with that. Thank you. Guy in Madison will go to you now. Hi, Guy.
Hello, Larry. So I have woodbine, which is a variation of Virginia creeper, and it's on the northeast side of the house, and where it gets sun especially, it has, and I've used it as a ground cover there, it gets fungal disease. And I have tried a regimen of chemicals that I'm reluctant to do. I've irrigated from below where it needs it. Actually, I haven't irrigated at all, but I'm giving up on that. I'm about ready to rip it up and try something else because it just gets diseased and looks horrible. I try cleaning it up too, but so I don't know if you have any advice, last rites advice for this thing.
And what is leading you to think that? So I initially I'm a little you said woodvine or woodbine?
Woodbine, Parthenosis incerta, which is basically a Virginia creeper, which is Parthenosis quinquefolia. Yes, and woodbine has some slight differences, and it doesn't have the suction cups or as many of them.
Interesting. Okay.
So it has tendrils, which I suppose is the reason for the botanical name incerta.
Oh, okay.
If you look at it, you'd say it's Virginia creeper.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And is this growing in a sunny or a shady area? I didn't quite catch that.
It's morning sun. It's on the, like I say, the northeast side of the house, but far enough away where it gets quite a bit of morning sun. Oddly, from a fungal standpoint, it gets the part that's shaded the most, that's kind of clinging to the stucco walls as best as it can, is the least affected, and that's the most shaded area. But that's also under the eaves, too, so it's not getting that rain from as much on the top.
Yeah.
So that's really a problem. I'm just sort of fed up with it.
So yeah. Are you considering, I mean, especially fungal problems, if you have plants that are persistently affected by fungal diseases, there's not really much getting away from that without either just extremely nasty chemicals. But, you know, problems like that are more of a cultural condition or something that is just inherent to the plant itself. So it sounds like maybe it's just time to look into exploring a different plant option for you.
Yeah.
I guess so. I also have that problem a little bit with what I was worried about when I planted with this, and it's true, that this would become a horrible weed, and I would be dealing with how to contain it. And now it's dying instead.
I'd yeah. get rid of it.
Yeah, and we do, you know, there's a lot of both, you know, partial shade tolerant, a little bit more easy to wrangle vines out there. You know, one option that might come to mind, depending on whether you're, it's a little hard to picture how much sun you're really getting, but variations of our native honeysuckle, Lanicera sempervirens. There's some nice cultivars out there that are, the native plant is red, and then there's some variations that are either like a coral color, they attract hummingbirds. Hardy kiwi. Kiwi is a really
nice one, too.
Beautiful vine yeah. that has gorgeous foliage. So you've got some options.
Thanks, Guy, for calling. Appreciate it. Erin Presley, our guest today, horticulturist at Old Brick Botanical Gardens in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Erin Presley, horticulturist at Old Brick Botanical Gardens in Madison. She cares for the herb, the wildflower, and the pond gardens, and she's interested in native woodland gardening, low maintenance, and sustainable garden, anything to do with growing, cooking, and eating your own herbs and vegetables. And she usually brings me something, and she did today a couple of items. One that has to do with the Hmong garden at Old Brick, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. So this past summer, we worked on a really awesome gardening project with one of our interns, Sabrina Herr, who is Hmong. And between Sabrina and her family and a lot of help from other Hmong organizations and ag organizations here around Madison, created this awesome garden that showcases a lot of plants that are significant in Hmong culture, both when you think of the Hmong culture as it exists and existed in Laos and Thailand, and then when a lot of Hmong people actually moved to the United States and Wisconsin, because here in Wisconsin there's actually about 60,000 Hmong people who live here that came here after the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. and they are just a huge part, actually, of our agricultural economy. And but they grow just, you know, if you go to any farmer's market anywhere, amazing variety of vegetables. And so we're growing both things that you're kind of used to seeing in farmer's markets here in Wisconsin, and then a lot of plants that are really specific to the Hmong culture. So if you think of a lot of kind of Southeast Asian flavors like ginger and turmeric, we grew sorghum, which is used as a kind of like sugar cane and mm-hmm. almost like candy. So you can cut it into sections. It's kind of has a stalk like corn. And then you peel off the outer fibrous parts, and the inside is kind of this fibrous, really crunchy, infused with liquid, like sweet, sugary, candy-like interior you can kind of suck and chew on. And then we offered also some veggie samplings throughout the summer. Another really interesting crop was Hmong sticky corn. And so the corn cobs are kind of short and stubby compared to what we would think of like our usual sweet corn. And then the corn has a really great flavor, and it's kind of sticky and like glutinous in its texture. So it's really has like very toothsome, really good flavor, and you just eat it like corn on the cob. And then another crop that was really popular was the cucumbers. And the cucumbers that are typically grown by Hmong people for their own usage are like, if you think of what we would think of as like a slicing cucumber, but then make it like 5 times bigger. So the cucumbers, what I swear, some of them were like 4 pounds. And then you actually, they're considered at their peak ripeness when they go past being green and then turn kind of like a golden yellow color. And you scoop out the flesh of the cucumber and then add a little bit of sugar and ice. And it creates this really great textured drink.
And it is good.
Yes. And the cucumbers, when they're fully ripe, have almost like a lemony tang. So we, a couple times over the summer, whipped up some batches of this drink to share with people, made some great community partnerships. And then next year, we're looking at doing some expanded activities, including hosting a mini farmers market and some cooking demonstrations at Ulbrich, as well as partnering with a Midwest-based author and artist to her, and then introducing, using his art and literature to introduce people to the Hmong culture as it kind of has been translated here in the Midwest. So,
well, I tell you, that drink, that cucumber drink is really
good.
You kind of use a spoon with it, too.
Yeah, yeah, it has a good texture, and especially on like a hot summer day, which we do have a little bit of that warm weather left today, really refreshing.
And I like the apple cider, too, from your mom and dad's place.
Yeah. I got some, was up there last weekend and produced some cider and pasteurized a little bit to bring in here today. And we're actually having our holiday show this year is Ulbrich's Homegrown Holiday. And so it kind of focuses on all of the amazing agricultural products that people are producing throughout the state, from, you know, orchards to ginseng to cheese and dairy to everything great at the farmers markets that we have here, maple syrup. So it should be kind of, you know, a little dose of nostalgia, and then also incorporating all of the other types of people here that are contributing to our agricultural economy as it exists today.
And when is that?
That is coming up during the month of December. So we'll just be getting set up here in a few weeks. I know, it actually feels like it's kind of around the corner.
Well, I'm looking forward to making that event.
That
sounds like a lot of fun.
It should be a really good one this year. We're really looking forward to it.
And, of course, all your events and so forth are on your website, and it's always good to go take a look.
Yeah, we had a brand spanking new website that launched this summer. So if you were used to looking at the old one, you're going to be really impressed with how snazzy and navigable our current website is. So all of our events are on there, as well as some really nice overviews of the gardens, our community partnerships, just a lot of other gardening resources as well.
And the address is just Ulbrich.
It's www.olbrich, so that's olbrich.org.
All right. Tom in Green Bay has something. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hey, I have a quick question regarding castor bean plants and composting. So castor beans, I guess the plant components of it contain ricin. And now that it's getting towards the fall and it's going to die off for the winter, you know, I would like to, you know, cut it back and, you know, compost it, but I'm worried about, you know, the leftover, you know, minuscule amounts of ricin that are in there. You know, do they break down after a certain point in time? Or if I, you know, add them to my garden to compost, is that always going to be in there? So that's the question.
Boy, that's... I don't know the answer to that one.
Yeah, I would say that is... you know, my gut tells me that that's not really a worry if you're running like a, you know, warm, hot compost pile where things are legitimately being broken down to the point where they are like physically and structurally no longer identifiable as the plant parts that they came from. But I am not an expert on any subject like that. So I, if you're worried about it at all, maybe it is worth looking into, and I would just, it also depends too whether you're using that compost for something that you're going to eat, like in a container veggie garden or on your, you know, outdoor veggie garden, or if you're just using it on other garden beds, you know, obviously that would contribute to how seriously you're going to take this inquiry. But I mean, that's really worth reaching out to a specialist for if it's on your mind.
Yeah, I would look into that because ricin is... Nothing to be fooled with, that's for sure.
Yes.
Tom, I wish you're going to have to look into this a bit more. I'm sorry.
Yeah, any ricin experts out there listening, talk to Tom.
Gail emailed, where can she learn more about how to plan a woodland plantings and shrubs in her yard? She has a small prairie in one portion of her yard, would also like to expand natives and in a tree and wooded area with a more woodsy look, adding native plants and shrubs. So she'd like to have very minimal mowing and on her 4-acre plot.
Yeah. When people are looking into getting into more native gardening styles, whether you have a sunny or a shady spot, one of the first resources that I send people to kind of capture the philosophy of why you're doing what you're doing, as well as get some really good plant lists, are some of the books by Doug Tallamy. So specifically, and Doug Tallamy is a author and a researcher based out of the Mid-Atlantic and the East Coast. But one of his, a resource of his that I look at a lot is a book called Bringing Nature Home. And it talks a lot about of the wildlife benefits to plants in both shady and sunny locations. Has some really good plant lists in there. I'm sure, you know, a perusal of just resources online will find something good that's more based to Wisconsin. Additionally, one of my particular interests at work and one of the areas that I love gardening in is our woodland garden, which is kind of a native forested garden based on what you would see in a Wisconsin woodland area. And I just personally have some good plant lists and some plants that have worked really well for me. That's one of my just particularly beloved areas at Olbrich. And so if you want to shoot me an email, I can send you some of my plant lists and, you know, even a few personalized recommendations. So my name is Erin, my last name is Presley. So my email is epresley, E-P-R-E-S-L-E-Y, @cityofmadison.com. And I'd be happy to share some of those plant lists and some ideas with you.
There you go. Thanks so much for that question. Grant emailed to ask for a safe way to infuse fresh tarragon into olive oil. He's concerned about the possibility of botulism.
So this kind of goes back to our conversation about properly drying herbs. And so if you're infusing herbs, there's things that you can infuse them in that have enough of their own antiseptic properties that you can use fresh herbs. So if you do like a vinegar infusion, you can use fresh herbs for that. If you're using an oil, though, it's important to start with dry, properly dried herbal material. And a lot of times if I'm drying herbs or using herbs really for anything, I'm a big stickler for washing things first. So even if you are going to dry it, I think it's important to start with as clean of a product as you can. So give everything a really thorough wash in, a tub of water. Pat it dry, you know, get the plant material when you're trying to dry as possible when you're starting. Follow some of those tips that we talked about earlier on the show as far as this would be again another one where I think using a dryer or a very low oven to get them really thoroughly dry is important, and then proceed with your infusion from there.
Christy in Chippewa County, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. So in my HOA, we are removing buckthorn from common property, and we've been reading how the leaves of the buckthorn alter the soil chemistry because of high nitrogen and calcium in the buckthorn leaves. We're familiar with Doug Tallamy and have listened to Neil Dybul as far as buckthorn management. So for that soil, for our soil to amend to a healthier condition, in addition to a soil test, do we simply let time leach through and restore that soil, or is there another site we could be looking at? Thank you.
Yeah, I don't really know if you're going to be able to find particular recommendations as far as remediating what you might consider to be these problems that are left behind by the buckthorn removal. My one recommendation would be if you can amend the soil using leaves that are gathered from elsewhere. So say everybody at your HOA is collecting the leaves from their yard that are falling on their grass, and collect those leaves and then start piling those in the areas that you're taking the buckthorn out, because you're kind of replicating what would be happening in more of a healthy forested setting by adding those, you know, more leaves of native trees, or at least not buckthorn, back in. That would be one thing that would first come to mind. And honestly, I am hesitant to think that whatever soil effects that are left behind by the buckthorn removal are really going to have a problem that's going to linger with you for very long. So I would maybe start small as you're adding beneficial plantings back into that area. But honestly, I don't think anything that you're planting back in, at least as far as woody plant material, is really going to be phased at all by any, you know, kind of temporary changes that the buckthorn have left behind.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you could also check at Prairie Nursery, too, with Neil. Neil would, DeBoel would probably echo what Aaron just said. Thank you so much for calling. Patty in Eden, Wisconsin. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I was just calling to add something to the castor bean item. As far as we were taught in our Master Gardener classes here, in Fond du Lac County, the seed is the only thing in the plant that contains the ricin. So if it's not gone to seed, it should be good to compost.
Okay. Well, I hope our earlier caller was listening in. Patty, thank you.
Yeah, that's a good tip. Thank you.
Appreciate that very much. Let's see. Grant emailed us to... I'm sorry. Already asked that question. Let's go to Karen. Karen emailed to ask you for tips on dry creek design for shady, damp areas. She says her pipe dream is to include moss in the mix where ferns, ajuga, wild ginger, and hosta are happy.
Oh, great. So you already have an existing area where you're kind of creating the right cultural conditions for the moss to really be happy. And we're, you know, really lucky here in Wisconsin. We have some good examples of moss gardens. So I know there's a private garden down towards Waukesha, as well as a at Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. They have a really beautiful moss garden. So I would even consider maybe, and you know, one of the real benefits of using mosses in the garden is typically they're evergreen. So if you can get down there, you know, anytime in the next, you know, throughout the early part of the winter, if there's not snowfall, I'd say go down there for some inspiration, or maybe get a hold of the folks at Rotary. I believe they have a real dedicated volunteer crew that maintains that moss garden, and they could probably give you some more specialized tips as far as establishing moss in some of these areas where your other plants are already really happy. I know my sister has a beautiful moss garden up against the north side of her house. And I think another thing that is always referenced as being really important is if you have little patches of moss that are already native on your property and you can really carefully kind of harvest little bits from there, you're going to have the best success using mosses, as well as have, you know, being looking towards sustainable harvesting if you're able to just propagate from what is already existing within your site versus any kind of moss that you would be getting in from elsewhere.
Kathy in Watertown emailed. She put her upright rosemary plant in the ground this past summer and it thrived. She plans to harvest and dry a lot of it soon. She's hesitant to dig up the plant and bring it indoors because she's failed growing rosemary in the past. Would she have better luck propagating it? And any tips?
Yeah, rosemary is a plant that comes well from cuttings Typically, again, a lot of these things when it comes to overwintering things, either as plants or as cuttings, are better done a little bit earlier in the season while the plants are still actively growing. Even the cuttings, you know, maybe are a little bit more likely to take from plants that have a little bit more gas in the tank, I guess. But that's not to say that it's not worth trying. And rosemary does well from cuttings that can be like semi-woody. So you could have a crack at, you know, cutting off a couple sprigs of rosemary and then cutting them down. And you're going to be looking for the parts of the rosemary that are a little bit, you know, about halfway down the stem where it starts to turn brown and woody, not the real little skinny green growing tips. And then, you know, take a cutting that's maybe 3/4 inch long. So you're taking little sections of the rosemary that are about 3/4 inch, strip off the bottom leaves. So the bottom, at least half an inch plus, strip off the leaves there, put them in some moist potting mix, and then in a real shallow little tray or little cells, and then put them in an area where you can keep them evenly moist. So a lot of people, if they do cuttings, will put a plastic bag over the whole tray to keep the moisture in. So, I mean, that's worth a try. That's worth a try, too, if you're looking for a way to keep that rosemary going and have some plants ready for next year.
John wonders if there are any unusual herbs that we could try.
Yes, this is one thing that I, you know, we're always looking to grow just different interesting plants, and expand our knowledge. So, last year I was really into this combination of Peruvian herbs, and they're the ahi peppers, which are a really old ancestral pepper. And many of them have really citrusy flavors. And then you can combine them into a really tasty Peruvian sauce using the leaves of a Peruvian marigold, Tajides minuta. So it's a really tall marigold with finely dissected leaves, and doesn't really have much for flowers. But the leaves have this really pungent, earthy smell, and then combined with the brightness of those peppers was really amazing. You can make a really awesome sauce called wakate. That was one I got onto last year. And then this year, a plant that, you know, you have all these plants you see around you all the time and you'd never realize that people are using them for things that you'd never even dreamed of. So with the Hmong garden, we actually grew two plants that I'm really familiar with but never thought of as herbs. And they actually are combined into, next year we're planning on doing a cooking demonstration of this really medicinal, aromatic Hmong chicken soup. And it actually uses what I call Sweet Annie. And a lot of people use it as herbal wreaths. It's Artemisia and Anua. And I never would have thought that you used it to eat. And the other plant that goes into this soup is Talinum paniculatum, which a lot of people grow ornamentally, and it's known as Jewels of Opar. And it's, again, just a beautiful, sprightly little garden plant. And then you use the seeds of that as a spice in the soup that we're going to be making next year. So there's just surprises at every turn.
Well, that's a great way to end the show today. Excuse me. Thank you so much, Erin, for being with us. I'll look forward to your next visit.
Yeah, thanks, everyone.
Erin Presley, horticulturist at Old Brick Botanical Gardens. So much fun talking with her. And I'm glad you were listening in today. Monday, Bassam Shakashiri is going to be back to talk about some fun Halloween science experiments. And then the weather guys will talk about sea ice and water spouts. Water spots. Water spouts. Put it that way. I got it. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.